Just before I start, I want to take a quick straw poll, and you can raise your hands. I won't ask you to actually name them, but how many of you in this room could recognize and name, let's say recognize, if you saw them in the grocery store back home, your member of Congress and two senators? That's good. And as they say, you know, this is a biased sample, since most of the people who come to advocacy sessions are pretty engaged in advocacy. How many of you, if you were in the grocery store, your member of Congress and two senators would recognize you and say hello and call you by name? That's good. That's great. Better than most, I'll tell you. So that's encouraging. But I will say, this room should be full. And we always have a hard time at meetings getting people to recognize the importance of advocacy. You're doing better than the last conference I was at. We had seven people. We're a little smaller than APHA, but still, I don't know how else to say this than we are in a fight for our lives, plain and simple. And you in the field, you know it. You're feeling it. And this is just the beginning. We are facing the biggest threats we've seen in decades. And the Affordable Care Act decision today, this is just the tip of the iceberg. Nicole and I and Laura, my colleague Laura Hanen here from NACHO, you know, we're your registered lobbyists. We're in Washington, we're doing the meetings, we're trying to get you engaged. We cannot win this war alone. And in fact, more and more members of Congress don't want to hear from us at all. If it's not coming from back home, if it's not coming from you in real America, they don't care. And they're telling us that. I keep voting for cuts because all I hear from my constituents is cut, cut, cut. And I guarantee they're a vocal minority. And most of the people who are pushing cuts have no idea what these government programs do for them in their daily lives. And that's terrifying. And no one is out there, and members of Congress are telling us this, no one from back home is telling me why these programs are important. And it's not just public health, it's all of them. Why are these programs important? Why is this an important role of the federal government? And why do we need to keep investing? That's what this is about, and that's why my talk is more, I'll cover some on public health policy, but it's really more about fiscal policy, because right now, fiscal policy is driving everything. The debt and the deficit, and these are wonky things that a lot of people don't know about, a lot of Americans don't understand. They think they do, but they don't, and unfortunately, the uninformed are driving this process, and it will be devastating, and if we don't stop it, it will take us decades to rebuild, and we may not be able to rebuild. So I don't mean to be alarmist, but I'm very serious about this. And hopefully by the end, you'll recognize this as well. So what we're going to do, again, because this is wonky stuff, it's, you know, when you're an advocate, knowledge is power, right? You have to be able to talk about these things. You have to be able to understand them and talk about them in an easy, understandable way. So that's what I'm going to try to do today without hopefully your eyes glazing over. And then talk a little bit about the end about what I think you can do to help. Just to start really quickly, two very important terms, debt and deficit, often used interchangeably, but very different things. Oh, and I will say by caveat, you know, Nicole read my bio, I am not an economist by training. I'm a health policy expert. I'm not a fiscal policy expert. I've kind of learned this stuff over the course of the last 2 years because I've had to. And if I can do it, you can do it. So bear with me. We'll get through this. So the deficit is simply the difference between what the government takes in, either receipts, we call them, or revenue, and what we put out. That is, what is the government buying with your taxpayer money? When we are buying more than we take in, we run a deficit. And in order to continue to buy programs that people care about, we have to borrow. And we borrow by selling bonds and treasuries to local state governments, foreign countries, etc. The accumulation of deficit over time, that is our debt. So each year that we run a deficit and we're unable to pay it off by bringing in more money and or cutting back on what we're buying, that adds to our deficit, our debt. We pay interest on that debt. Just as you would do a credit card. So each month, if you're using a credit card and you're using your bills to pay your credit card, you're potentially running a deficit if you don't pay that off at the end of the month. Think of your collected credit card remaining balances over time as your debt, and you then pay interest on that debt, and you can see how that compounds. The U.S. debt right now is approaching $16 trillion. So this is outdated. I looked the other day, there's a debt counter online on Twitter. We're up now about 15.7 and counting. Other two terms I want to clarify, two in general types of spending, mandatory and discretionary, also called direct and indirect spending. We as advocates for public health, we hate the term discretionary because it makes it sound like you don't have to pay for these things, when in fact it's really meant to imply the sort of the process. Discretionary spending is determined annually at the discretion of Congress. So each year, appropriators come together, they put together a spending proposal, that goes through the rest of the Congress. Remember, Congress has the power of the purse. They control all the money. The president proposes, and the Congress disposes. And so all this power remains in Congress. That's what your discretionary spending is. Mandatory spending essentially happens automatically, and it's set by law. And so usually the terms of whether or not you are eligible for that benefit are defined in the law. For example, Medicare, being probably the largest mandatory program and probably the most well-known, even though many people don't realize it's a government program. The problem with mandatory spending, in order to change that spending, it kind of, again, if you're eligible, it just keeps going up and we pay those benefits. To change that spending, you have to change the eligibility rules through law, and that's hard. On average, it takes 7 years to pass legislating an authorizing bill, a bill that authorizes a new program. Appropriations bills should happen annually. Usually now it's like 18 months, but should happen every 12 months. So this is just, it's very fuzzy. I have a better graph, but I didn't get it until I submitted this presentation. But this shows you the breakdown of where we spend our money. 57% of where we spend our money is in those mandatory programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Really, Social Security is a little different because Social Security sort of pays for itself. Medicare and Medicaid, what's really driving that mandatory spending is healthcare costs that are rising. I will just make a note, I find this so interesting. Earlier this year, Congress passed a bill to patch Medicare physician payments for 10 months. To pay for that, they cut $6.25 billion from the Prevention and Public Health Fund. It takes, and that's money that's provided over 10 years. So for 10 years worth of public health and prevention funding, you get 10 months of Medicare physician payments. That's where most of our money is going. So you see the discretionary side, much smaller than mandatory. And on the discretionary side, what we have is other. We call this non-defense discretionary spending. Everything that's discretionary and not defense, that includes health, is about 18%, one-fifth of what we spend. Ironically, this is the only place anyone ever wants to cut, because obviously it's hard to cut the Defense Department and it's hard to cut mandatory spending. No one wants to cut Medicare. The green bar, you'll see, is health. So that includes basically all your discretionary health programs, CDC, FDA, Indian Health Service, HRSA, and the NIH. And the NIH makes up about half of this 2%. So they have about a $31 billion budget. So as you can see, what we're talking about for kind of core public health activities is an absolute fraction, it's really budget dust, of what we're spending overall. And this is just sort of a different graphical depiction of what that graph looks like. So how are we here? Why is everything now about the deficit? I would argue none of this is about the deficit, and none of it's about the debt. In the next couple of slides, we'll show you what are the kind of the true drivers of the debt and the deficit. And it makes sense historically as you would look, and probably not what you think. What's happening now is a fundamental debate about the role of the federal government in your lives. And there are those that believe the federal government has a role and has an important role and makes people's lives better. And there are those that believe that it does not. And it infringes on your liberty and it's infringing on your personal rights. Those people are winning. They are winning this debate. And this is not a political statement. This is not an endorsement of a political party. But that's what the debate is about right now. That's what this election is going to be about. And so if you believe public health, the federal role has a federal government has a role in public health, has a role in people's lives, you probably should know how to vote, but I'm not going to tell you. So this is information from the Pew Charitable Trust. I won't go through it all. Really, when you look at our national debt, that $16 trillion, this is what contributes to it. It's tax cuts. Most people don't think of tax cuts as costing money, but when you're not bringing in money, that actually counts as a cost. The war, the Medicare Part D expansion, the bank TARP, Wall Street bailout, and the stimulus fund are all really what's really driven the deficit, in addition to the fact that historically we have the lowest tax rates we've ever had, so we're bringing in less money than we ever have. We have also declining revenue amid a recession. You would expect this, as people aren't working, they're not paying taxes. So there's less coming in, and also with the escalating healthcare costs that we can't seem to figure out how to get a handle on, it's really kind of crowding out all the other available money. So this past year, what was interesting is for the first time, we had a real debate about something that's usually a pretty pro forma boat called the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling is our borrowing limit. How much are we going to allow ourselves to borrow? And each year, you know, as you might call your credit card company and ask if you could raise your limit, Congress does that every couple years. As we approach the debt ceiling, we vote to raise it, no big deal. And the people that vote against it usually do because it's a symbolic vote and they know it's going to pass anyway, but they want to be able to say, I voted against the debt ceiling. This year, coming on the heels of the Tea Party wave, they were serious, and they said, we will not vote to raise the debt ceiling if we do not see that offset by commensurate levels of cuts in spending, in discretionary spending, for the most part. And so what we saw there at the 11th hour, our rating was downgraded for the first time ever because of this nonsense. And so what we ended up with was something called the Budget Control Act. And the Budget Control Act is an attempt to make a dent in the deficit over the next 10 years. And it's two phases. We're going to raise the debt ceiling by the amount we need to get through the November elections, but we're going to cap discretionary spending over the next decade, essentially at flat levels. That ends up being a cut over time. And then we're going to appoint this bicameral, bipartisan group of folks, we call them the super committee, to determine where we're going to come up with the rest of the money, either through tax increases, entitlement reform, possibly some more discretionary cuts. If they cannot do that, we will end up with something called sequestration. Sequestration will take effect January 2013. Because the super committee failed. Seven out of 12 people could not agree on how to come up with $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction in a balanced way. Every bipartisan committee of experts who live and breathe this stuff is saying if we want to be serious about bringing down the debt, we need $4 trillion in deficit reduction. So we couldn't even get to $1.2 trillion. So what that means is this January, if Congress can't figure it out in a bipartisan way, we're going to see cuts to non-defense discretionary programs. This is just kind of the breakdown of where you'll see how much money's coming out over the next decade. But essentially, it works out being about 8 to 12% of everything. So CDC funding, NIH funding, Department of Education funding, transportation funding, Homeland Security, all of it across the board as of January 2013. So this is just sort of a recap of, how is this impacting this year's appropriations process? Because this is all, the appropriations process continues in the midst of all this. What we're really seeing is, this is providing the backdrop to the appropriations process and making it more complicated. This just kind of runs down sort of where we are. And already, even though the Budget Control Act, we thought this would make things easier because it set that discretionary cap, which is really the size of the pie, how much appropriators going to have to divvy up. The House even then said that wasn't low enough. So even though we had a bipartisan agreement about what the size of the pie would be, they decided that wasn't enough and they wanted to go smaller. Not only did they make the size of the pie smaller, they took more from non-defense discretionary programs like public health and put that into defense. So when you look at the discrepancy between what the House is working with and what the Senate's working with, you're looking at a difference of about $27 billion. That has to be rectified somehow. For labor, HHS, and education, the bill that deals with public health funding, it's about an $8 billion discrepancy between the House and Senate, and it's unclear how that's going to play out. So as we're coming in, no one wants to do anything before the election. That's clear. We have the following to get through, an omnibus measure. So this is the spending bill that will wrap up all the other spending bills. We're not going to be able to get anything done before September 31st, the end of the fiscal year. The Bush tax cuts are expiring at the end of this year. The extenders package expires again. Remember, this is unemployment benefits, the payroll tax holiday, and the Medicare physician payment patch. To fix that and prevent a 30% reduction in physician payments will cost $300 billion. We have another debt ceiling fight coming because we're going to hit the debt ceiling later this year, probably in the lame duck. And we also have this sequester storm circling with 12% cuts. This is just, and you have the slides, where we are with health. Health, if you can believe it, has fared pretty well compared to the other functions of government. On average, we've been cut about 5% since fiscal year 2010. We're seeing flat funding essentially in the Senate for fiscal year 2013. But within that 5%, there's a wide variation in where the cuts are. So NIH has been essentially flat funded, CDC cut by about 12%. So in summary, what you have to do is, yes, you have to care about public health funding. You cannot care about public health funding if you don't care about these larger fiscal issues, and you have to start engaging in them now. We're going to need a balanced approach to get out of this deficit mess and to avoid sequestration, a balanced approach being looking at other areas of our budget, not just the discretionary side. They have to hear from you. I underlined this in red. They don't care what we have to say. And Laura is like so amazing what she's doing in her department, her state. It's really remarkable. It should be a model for every state. I'm really just dumbfounded because we talk about all the time how do we get people engaged, and she's doing it. It's really amazing. They have to hear from you. I will remind you, a lot of people say, I'm a state public health employee. I'm a state employee. I can't do it. That's not so. The Supreme Court has actually ruled on this and said that your place of employment does not take away your First Amendment right to petition your government. You can't go in saying, I'm here as the state director of health for the state of New Jersey, but you can be there as a citizen. And just because you work for the federal or state government or local government does not mean you give up that right. And it has to happen now. It's absolutely critical. It does not just have to happen in Washington. As Laura mentioned, there are state offices, district offices for every member of Congress. There are town hall meetings. And also, you don't just have to talk to your member of Congress. Talk to your neighbors. Talk to your family and be like, do you realize what's going to happen? What's going to go away? Clean food, clean water, clean air, educational opportunities, police officers, law enforcement, first responders, all of these things are at risk. And what's so interesting is when 80% of Americans say the government is too big, whatever that means, and it needs to be smaller. When you start to connect the dots and say, okay, where do we make those cuts? And when you ask them where to cut, it absolutely flips. 80% say, no, I don't want to cut education. I don't want to cut public safety. I don't want to cut medical research. Don't cut Medicare. Don't cut anything. So when you connect the dots for people, they begin to understand. And we, again, in Washington, can't do that alone. People need to be more active and engaged. So I hope that was cheerleader enough. And I apologize, I was not emailing. I like to live tweet. So I was live tweeting while my other panelists are talking. You can follow me at Health Funding for the Coalition for Health Funding. And I'll take questions. And I went over. I apologize. Sorry. I don't know how to do it other than that way. So we.
Should be, yep.
So we left a lot of time for Q&A. I know a lot of the other sessions, the speakers took more time, but we really felt in this kind of session that it would be good to have a really good dialogue with all of you. I am too short. Can you see me? The goal I think of the last few days, and please anybody from APHA can correct me, but I think the goal from the last few days, I've been taking notes in my sessions, it seems like the first few days we were talking about important issues. What obstacles and challenges we face, what opportunities we have before us. And I feel like today, what we're talking about today are the tools that we need to make this all work, to address those opportunities and address those challenges. And so I think with our time that we have left, I would like to explore with all of you all on how we can do this and how we can do this better, this advocacy thing. And a couple of the sessions that I went to, I see Gene Matthews here. In the session where he presented, he talked about public health in the political kill zone. And I think with some of the things that Emily discussed and some of the things that we learned about through the presentation that Don Berwick put forward, I think, you know, we're facing a time when we really need to be talking about these things and we really need to be educating and advocating. And I think Dr. Berwick, in his presentation to open our session, talked about public health seemingly to have uncritical advocacy and myths around us. And so breaking through some of those myths and making advocacy critical, I think, is something that's very important. So there's a mic here. Please come up and really let's have a good dialogue. I think we would all be interested in hearing about what you are doing around advocacy as well, mm-hmm. and in any way that we can be helpful in answering questions. I will say, I am a fiscal policy expert. I would count myself as that. I was a budget analyst for a long time. I worked for the House Appropriations Committee for a long time. So I can talk about the budget stuff if need be. And I know my panelists here can talk about the legal ramifications, the health policy, and then how this works at the local level. So I think we have a really good panel here. So please.
Thank you. Very nice presentations. Justin Moore, University of South Carolina. Two things. One, self-serving. As the representative here from the newly formed physical activity section, I'd like to thank you for the activity breaks. We have been advocating that they be institutionalized as part of every presentation. I appreciate everyone's support. I got shut down last time. But we're going to keep advocating. Second thing, one of my favorite quotes, which may offend someone, but that's not my problem, is that, you know, not all conservatives are stupid, but stupid people tend to be conservative. Which means that very simple arguments tend to carry the day. Mm-hmm. Our arguments tend to be extremely complex. How on earth do we break this down into 5 minutes with our senator, into 5 minutes at a dinner party with someone? I've been recently asked to be on a radio show. I have 10 minutes to talk about healthcare reform. How do we break this down into things that the standard person is so much on their plate, and I don't mean that everyone disagrees with us, but they're busy people, and we know from psychology that simple arguments tend to be more salient. So how do we conquer that?
That was something that we had to learn, and, you know, because we were getting public health speak, and a lot of people don't know what public health speak. I mean, we would throw out evidence-based. This is evidence-based, it's wonderful, I'll go, you know, over their heads. And so what we have been told by legislative staff is, if you can bring us stories are huge. If you can bring us stories in regards to how these cuts in this funding affects these people, that is what we need to hear, because those senators and those representatives will repeat those stories. And so that's what we've learned to do is to tell the stories. And then what we also learned to do amongst our own members is they didn't seem to be able to respond to, if you don't call Senator Baucus, you're going to get cut $600 billion. But if you don't call Senator Baucus, you're probably going to lose your public health emergency preparedness program. You're going to lose your Montana Cancer Control Program. The immunization action money you're getting is going to be gone. We're not going to have CDC to turn to for advice and help. And so the more you can put it on their level, the better off you are, because people then can repeat those stories. But they can't repeat public health speak. They can't repeat the stuff that we're so comfortable with and that we can talk about ad nauseum. So that would be my suggestion.
Just to add to that, we also need to recognize that just because something is right or just because something is good doesn't make it so. And so you need to think about the people that you're trying to influence, what will affect them, and how do you find something that will appeal to their self-interest. That just saying, we need healthier children or we need better food, they'll say, whatever. And so how do you make it something that appeals to them? And doing research and thinking about how do you tailor your message, and not just saying, well, this is good, this is the right thing to do, this is just, but how do you really tailor that message to the specific person that you're trying to reach?
I would say too, I'm going to add to that a little bit. You don't need to be an expert on the legislation that maybe you're talking about. You don't necessarily even need to be the 100% expert even in that public health area. In fact, sometimes it's easier if you're not, because then you don't use the jargon. And I think making that emotional connection, moving policy and legislation, I mean, political science is science, but it's also art. And so you can have as much evidence and science in the world, but if you don't make that emotional connection with a policymaker or the staff of the policymaker, then your arguments are going to fall flat. So when we talk about storytelling, there's always a protagonist in a story, right? So if you can relate something to, even if it's a made-up individual, the story doesn't have to be based 100% on fact. You know, Sally came into our office. Sally is just a name for all of the children that we immunize in our health center. But Sally came into our office, and she didn't have insurance. Or Sally came to our office, she was underinsured. Her parents could not afford the co-pays that her physician's office was requiring for her to make. So what does public health do? Public health fills that void. Public health provides that vaccine for Sally. And because we provided that vaccine for Sally, that will protect her school. That will protect others in her school. That will protect her little baby brother who can't get the vaccine right now because of his age. And if we don't do that, no one else will. That's the power of public health. There, I just told a story. And that then, oh my God, I'm excited. What can I do to help Sally? Well, what you can do is you can make sure that the Prevention of Public Health Fund continues. $190 million of the Prevention of Public Health Fund is going toward immunizations. So that, I think, getting it down into a story, getting it down into where they can relate and knowing where they are. If you know that the congressman that you're speaking to or the staff that you're speaking to is one of the anti-vaccine people, maybe you don't lead with that story. but... You know, you talk, you know your audience, and you relate it back into terms that they can understand. It still uses the public health science that we know.
And I'll just add, so a couple things. You know your audience. That's critically important. I'm going to steal this line from Dr. Lisa Simpson, who's speaking at the closing plenary from Academy Health. Data make you credible, but stories make you memorable. So it goes with this theme. Also, something that's been really interesting during this sequestration debate is watching the defense industry and what they're doing. So my new acronym is WWDD, what would defense do it? Let's act like the defense industry. Don't be afraid to overstate the importance or the threat. For example, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs came out and said, if we have sequestration and we cut the Defense Department by 10%, we will be at greater risk of war. Nicole, I think I said it to her, she's like, I don't even know what to imply for that. He can't prove that. No one can prove it won't happen. So we were going back and forth saying, pandemic flu. I mean, and this is, you know, Democrats, I sit in fundraisers all the time with Democrats, we need to be better at messaging, we need to be better at messaging. And I always say, messaging is, it's not that Republicans are geniuses at messaging. Messaging is easy when you don't care about facts. Seriously, when you tell people what they want to hear. Job creators. What jobs? We have 10% unemployment. We have lowest tax rates in history. What jobs are we creating? But it doesn't matter. You know, in public health, and I think Democrats in general, we recognize that everything in the world is either shades of gray, it's policy, nothing is black and white. Republicans don't operate in that universe. It's black, it's white, it's simple, and it's easy to remember and easy to communicate, and it works. If you think of advocacy as sales, you're selling a product, you're selling public health. It's what am I gonna do to get you to support this program today? I mean, that's really what this is about. And when you talk to a salesman when you're buying a car, they don't tell you everything that's wrong with the car. They tell you what's great about the car. They tell you what you want to hear. So that's what we as advocates really need to do, and we shouldn't be ashamed of it. That's how this game works. I think for me, the best example is if you look at the budget for the Democrats and Republicans in the House, The Democrats' budget, I can't even remember, it's like 23 words long in title. Democratic budget to, you know, protect the middle class and preserve Medicare benefits and on and on and on. And then underneath, in the fine print, it says, subtitle, this budget does not necessarily reflect all the views of the Democratic Party. And I thought, Jesus Christ, are you kidding? The Paul Ryan budget, path to prosperity. There is nothing prosperous about that budget. But he has no shame of saying it, and it gets on the airwaves, and the news media starts repeating it, because that's what it's called, and people believe it. They believe it's the path to prosperity. It eliminates non-discretionary spending over the next 10 years. Eliminates. No NIH, no CDC, nothing. And nobody talks about it. It erodes the social safety net. It balances the budgets on the backs of our nation's most vulnerable. It's outrageous, but it's the path to prosperity. So again, what would defense do? WWRD. What would Republicans do? We need to be more aggressive, flat out. So, we're losing this battle. We're losing.
So I think that this would be a really good time to, again, stand up.
And I think
we need to stretch to the right. Really, really hard. How are we going to do this? And I'll just say, too, while we're stretching, I work for a Republican.
Oh, my God.
So it's not like everybody here on this panel is saying Republicans are evil.
No. No, they're not.
So I didn't want to say that.
And I also want to just put in a caution as the lawyer, too. That while you want to be fired up, you do want to, as public, whether you're with a public health agency, whether you're with APHA, which is a 501c3 organization, you do want to be really careful about not being partisan. That while you can, in many contexts, support legislation, while you can encourage the passage of bills, the budget, you can encourage, you cannot support candidates. You cannot support parties. And so you, and that goes to not just endorsing candidates, not just giving money to candidates, but that also means that, for instance, APHA, as a 501c3 organization, could not do a comparison of Romney's and Obama's healthcare views and then say, okay, this is what they think about public health. You decide who to vote for. So you do want to be careful about that. And if you have questions about how to do that, feel free to call me and we can talk more about that. But I do want to just put that caution out there.
As an organization. But as an individual, you absolutely can and should. I would argue. Give to who supports your purpose.
So after sitting and listening this morning, I've learned that the truth of the matter is the evidence base suggests that if the prevention fund is cut, the world will end on December 27th. That's the message that we should all take.
We won't be able to eat food or drink water after. Yeah, I'm going to go with that. That's going to be my statement. The Joint Chiefs can say that we're going to go to war. I'm going to say, I'm sorry, if this happens, if the question happens, I pray to God that you do not eat anything or drink anything.
My name is Andrew Trautman, of course. I think I'm the president-elect right here. Two quick points to the question, really. One of the areas I find most confusing, which was just covered, and I think most of us are confused about it, is fiscal policy. And how do we, and especially when issue is not very sexy in face, and also very complicated in face. And populations that we address often are the least organized and the least motivated for various reasons that we know very well to get involved and engaged. So the really first question is, how do you take this particular very difficult issue like fiscal policy and break that down in such a way that people get connected to it and feel that they need to do something about it? The second question is, I recently joined the academic world after 30 years of practice, and as I try to figure out what the hell that means, what about universities and lobbying and advocacy? I know the state is private, and I have to work with universities. I'm part of a state institution in a state where the governor is crazy. So that complicates my issue, but the basic question is, anybody from Florida? Yeah, this gentleman returned billions of dollars in transportation funds to build a high-speed rail from Tampa to Orlando because it says it's going to be a tax burden and not create jobs, which is not Kansas.
They encourage all your voters.
Yeah.
And if there's any Ohioans here, they feel your pain on that.
Same thing. But he also refused to let any state agency apply for community transformation grant funds. And every health department in the state is just a state.
He finally did allow the state health officials to sign on.
To this one?
To the PPP grant, yes.
Yeah, not the first one.
No, it's fiscal year 2012.
There are two.
The new one.
The new one was small.
Yeah, the Florida finally did come through in the end.
Emily talk more about the fiscal policy. The one thing that I would say about that is that we need to reframe the way we talk about it. So it's not just talking about fiscal policy. I love when I hear, and I was driving once, I heard this on the radio, and I almost drove off the road, where somebody's talking about, well, we have our, our value-based issues, and then we have the budget. I mean, there's nothing more that that the government expresses our values than through the budget. And so we need to change the way what people think about it, where it's not just a bunch of numbers, but that it really is real. And the last thing I'll say about that is that I always amazed when I go out and around the country and talk to groups and, people are like, well, we want to try to get money for our program. We're going to work on trying to increase our funding. And then I ask, well, do you know what the budget process is in your state? Do you know when the budget is introduced? And usually no one raises their hand. That it's really important that while, just for people to understand this process, because you can't get in it, because again, no matter how good your story may be and how sympathetic, if the budgets aren't passed, it's too late. So now I'll let you actually talk about this.
It is complicated, but it's not. It's money in, it's money out, right? So, when you boil it down to its most basic element, and for anyone to do anything, you need funding. I think a great example of this is the Affordable Care Act. There are hundreds of programs authorized in the Affordable Care Act that will never be implemented, because as long as there's an Affordable Care Act, there are members of Congress who will refuse to appropriate any funding for it. So money really drives everything. It drives policy change, it drives health outcomes, it drives everything, because we can't do anything without money. That's sort of the sad reality. And so I think when you put it in those terms for folks, I hope they begin to realize that, yes, this is complicated and it seems arcane and we use a lot of strange language that no one else really understands, but that's really what it boils down to. If you want to improve health, you have to have funding to implement these programs. That's sort of, the bottom line. I don't know if that resonates with people. Unfortunately, I think we almost have to have sequestration. I don't think Americans fully understand all the government does for them, and they won't until they don't do it anymore. And so it will not be until, it's that wake-up call that when people start getting sicker faster, when we can't catch, the latest food outbreak, it takes longer and more people start dying and people are wondering, why are so many people dying? Well, because we have close, 20% of the labs in the country. But it's not really until that happens that people start to realize. I think that's kind of an unfortunate reality, but I feel like that's almost what needs to happen.
And to get to the university question, Laura, have you been working with the universities as part of your stakeholder involvement in Montana, or are you working mainly with the public health departments?
Mainly with the public health departments, which is the program.
Yeah, we do have some individuals from the university systems that are working with us, but they haven't been as active.
So I can speak to my firm represents several universities. Universities have lobbyists. That's what they're. And I don't think people realize it, but whether or not you realize it, your university has a government relations team, or they have hired guns like me in Washington helping out the government relations team. So I would say, as an advocate, if you work for a university, just that you want to make sure, if you're working for a public institution, like a state public health department, that you're kind of checking with the rules there. If you're going to be going up to the Hill, you're taking your own personal leave, you're going as John Q. Citizen and you're using your personal email and your personal phone number, nothing related to the government. The same kind of is true for the university. So I think if you ever have questions, talk to your government relations team at your university and just as a courtesy, give them a heads up that, hey, I'm going to be going to meet with Senator Baucus, and this is what I'm going to be talking about. Just, they like to understand where kind of their people are, what they're talking about, because they have their own, the university agenda as well. So I think it's good to just work as closely as we can with USF and for those others who are at universities. I think that's always, transparency is always a good thing in that regard.
And I would say, too, There's also the ASPH, the American Schools Association of Schools of Public Health, that also have lobbyists as well. So there's an association for everything. So they're quite engaged.
I have a story and I have a quick request. My story is I'm Barb Levin and I'm a family physician for Burlington D, and I've been a health officer for 30 years. So I'm the longest remaining National Health Service Corps officer who's been at the same site for 32 years. That's it. Okay. I used to be longest and not oldest. Very important. Okay, so I've been seeing the same team going to Congress, going for my health center, going for APHA. And this year I was up and seeing our representative Duncan, who's actually being changed because all these things. He's a very fiscal conservative, and he actually got voted against the war because of fiscal conservatism. I like him a lot. He's very supportive. He does great. So I'm sitting, which is sort of choosing, and I've got the National Community Health Center thing in front of me, and he said, okay, so what are you selling today? I was just getting around to it because he knows how much it goes up. I said, well, here's the story. You know, in the budget, we're going to give us $2.8 million for all the health centers, but we really need $3 billion because with that, we can do 20 million people's health care. So he looked at me and he said, say that again. So I said, here's the deal. We're spending $10 billion a month that I don't want to spend on the war. And you're telling me I get 20 million people's health care for $3 billion? It's a deal. I'm about to stop breathing. Everyone in the National Association of Community Health Center stopped reading. He actually went on the website and did the whole thing. So my story is, you just don't know. I mean, I've been in that office probably 30 times and never have got any appropriations approved. But he went big time for the additional to get to $3 billion for health centers. My request is, I work every day with people who, again, are not stupid and are conservative and have very limited funds. They need to understand what they're going to lose. So my request is, I personally have not read the 2,000 pages of the Affordable Care Act. Would be really useful if somebody, a summer intern or somebody, could go and take stakeholders or communities and say, if this is what's in it for people over 50, this is what's in it for people over 70, this is what's going to happen if you're a community agency, and have those ready sound bites for this FAT campaign. Because I can hand that out with every prescription. I can't tell the people not to vote inappropriately,
right,
but
right.
I can tell them this vote will handle this thing. So I appreciate it.
I think we have some folks from APHA here who may be able to get to that issue about the FACT campaign. None of us would be in the, I guess, putting that FACT campaign together. I don't know, Caroline, you want to say something?
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you so much for that question. I'm Caroline Beckenberg from the Public Health Association. So I actually don't work directly with the FACT campaign, but I'd love to touch on that a little bit. I think that one of the challenges with this, for being on the other side, is from our perspective, it feels like there are a gazillion summaries of the Affordable Care Act out there. So Kaiser has a site, the HHS has, healthreform.gov, et cetera. So what we're trying to figure out is how do we get those into people's hands when they need it? So on the FAT campaign, I will pass that on to Don and his team.
It's not like I've seen those.
Okay.
Our list, we need sound bites.
Okay, so what are the talking points?
The 20
yeah.
words,
yeah.
If you're 50 years old, you might be concerned about A, B, B, B.
Okay, that's very helpful. I will pass it on to the FAT team. Thank you.
Thank you.
And for the future, the point is we need that before the bill passes. It's too late. I mean, the narrative has been defined. The messaging is out on the Affordable Care Act. It is all false. It's too late. I mean, the message has to be on. You have to have the soundbite. You have to be first. You have to be the first one out of the gate to define the message. And we're about 2 years too late, I'm afraid.
And I would say, I just add to the Tennessee delegation, I think is really exciting. One of my friends is the chief of staff to Marsha Blackburn. She serves on the Energy and Commerce Committee and who has health jurisdiction. And she's not always been our vocal upfront friend, but I know she does a lot for public health behind the scenes.
I think Lamar Alexander, he's not been the biggest champion of the Prevention Public Health Fund, but public health, I think, is one of his priorities. So I think knowing your audience and working with who you have, I think, is very important. So I appreciate your outreach to Jimmy Duncan.
Hi, my name is Ashley Wallerstrom, and I direct the Louisiana Community Health Worker Training Institute, which is based at Tulane School of Medicine. I just have a quick comment, which is there's a suggestion that when we're thinking about how to do advocacy and how to do messaging that's appropriate for community, get people involved in advocacy, I really encourage you to work with community health workers. These are folks who are on the ground all day, every day, doing outreach, doing health education. They have an excellent understanding of what community needs are and also how to communicate with people on the ground. So if you involve them, they'll be able to do a great job of figuring out how to spread your messaging. They will know the stories that you need, and they can act as excellent advocates. There are several pieces of research showing that they are great advocates. So I encourage you to connect with them. And one way to do that is to go through the community health worker section of APHA on the website. If you look under there, you'll see a list of all the community health worker networks throughout the United States, with the exception of Louisiana, where somehow we're not out there yet, but you want to talk to me, and I will connect you. So just want to make that suggestion. Thank you.
I'm Sally Ellen Mason. I'm a physician at Chicago Scott County Hospital and work at MCH. I think there's a peculiarly vicious and difficult part of the opposition message that I wonder if any of you or any of the audience has a pen of what to add in. So the day I left for this meeting, our paper, the Chicago Tribune, ran an article saying the people who come to your public hospital kind of can't so afford those cookies. They can't so afford this. The hospital's corrupt, not collecting the $4 for this medicine, that basically it's the undeserving poor and the clinic thing. So if you made your argument on the vaccine, they say they can't so afford their copay. They should just give up their coke and their cigarettes. So where do you have any message to that undeserving poor, that them versus us, that ownership society versus all the rest of this trash people who can't keep up?
I think I'll start and turn to my colleagues. I think that the message that we have for public health, we often are focused on protecting the disadvantaged and protecting the safety net, but I think a lot of the messages that do work are we protect everyone. So while we may be serving those in the safety net, those protections that we provide to those in the safety net are beneficial to all. So I think... Right, and the reason why there aren't measles in your suburban school district is that public health has been able to immunize, make sure that there are high immunization rates in the community, which is in part benefited by the fact that a lot of folks have insurance and they get their vaccinations covered in that way. But we're also providing vaccines to those folks who may not have the support, or may not think that they have the support they need. So we provide that to them when we collect co-pays when we can. But it's not always possible. But at the end of the day, we're trying to protect the entire community. So I think you just turn it around a little bit. That would be my recommendation, is saying rather than go on the defense, go on the offense.
I think that's perfect. Taking a page from Frank Luntz, who's the Republican strategist, and their wordsmith. Frank is, I think, brilliant, but also what he does is it's hard. He asks people what he want to hear, and they tell his Republican clients, this is what they want to hear, tell them that. And we don't do that. And so it's so important in the Coalition for Health Funding, he advocates for all discretionary health funding, including research and health professions training and all this stuff. And so when I'm trying to describe the rich portfolio of what is this $55 billion buying you from health, we always pick we pick three things. We pick medical research, we pick health professions training, and we pick preparedness disaster response, because we know everybody likes those things. And I, in my membership, I have Planned Parenthood and I have National Planning and Reproductive Health Association. I say, no offense, guys, I will never say Title 10 is an example of what discretionary health is doing. They'll bring the whole thing down with certain audiences. It's just knowing your audience and knowing what they want to hear. And, when you're talking with members of Congress who support programs who are vulnerable, that's public health. When you're talking to more conservative folks who think they don't need any of this stuff, it's food safety, it's immunizations, it's preparedness and disaster responding, what do they benefit from? Knowing what they want, what they benefit from, and talking about public health in those terms. And it's not lying, it's not distorting the facts, it's just telling them what they want to hear.
Yeah. So Laura, in your work in Montana, are you facing some of those same questions and challenges? People saying, well, why is public health needed when everybody can pay for this?
I would say that's one of the challenges that we face, and is the messaging. We need to message better, and I would say that's one of the challenges we face. You know, we don't know how to message, and so we're looking for someone to help us message.
Well, we could probably go on all day. This could be a whole meeting, I think, over 3 days. But I appreciate your involvement and your coming to this session. And we're all available over the next half an hour, although we may have our heads buried in the SCOTUS blog.
live stream
upstairs. Yes, that's right. It's live streamed upstairs in the Grand Ballroom.